brush, please.
Thank you very much. So yes, I should explain that I'm coming at this from the angle of my expertise, which is Monte Carlo event generation. That is a computer simulation of what happens in LHC collisions. And as I will try to explain to you, we have a rough idea of what happens, which we can simulate at the sort of level of, well, depending what you look at, but certainly better than 50% usually. For some purposes, this is adequate, and I'll try to explain what purposes that's adequate for. In other cases, we need more precision, and so I'll try to explain how we're trying to get more precision in these simulations and the obstacles which arise. So here's a couple of articles here. This is by a consortium of experts, so it's a review which is really, really detailed. And this is an article I wrote for this Scholarpedia thing on the web, which is a little more qualitative. So at the very simplistic level, we have a couple of protons coming in at the LHC, and they are almost, they can be treated as almost free collections of quarks and gluons. So at the most simple level, we have three quarks. Proton is made of an up, and a down. They carry the charge of the quark, of the proton, so they're called valence quarks. And so, of course, we could have a collision, say, between an up here and a down there. And not surprisingly, if we have a large momentum transfer, then we see something coming out in the final state, which has certain characteristics of these quarks. Although, obviously, as you probably know, we don't actually see quarks coming out in the final state. We see hadrons, which are bunches of quarks, or quarks and antiquarks, which are particles. Most of them, most of the things that come out are mesons, pi mesons, actually. Now, in addition to the valence, we get other stuff. For example, we get gluons, which are the quanta of the so-called QCD field, which bind the quarks together. And they'll be very important. And then we can also get extra quarks. But of course, now, because of the charge, they have to come out in pairs of quark antiquark. So, for example, we could have an extra UU bar here. And these are called C quarks. So we have valence quarks. We have C quarks. And we have gluons. So the first thing to note is that if we have a collision here, we need to know the momenta of the things that collide. And these are expressed in terms of the momentum fractions. If we have two protons with momenta P1 and P2, say, which are equal and opposite at the LHC, then we can have, say, X1 P1 here and X2 P2 there. And then it's a simple calculation in relativity to see that the center of mass energy of the collision, say between partons I, between quarks I and J in this case, I should say that these objects, quarks and gluons, are called partons when they are parts of the proton. That's Feynman's name for these objects collectively. Then it's a simple calculation to see that this is the geometric mean of X1 and X2 times the LHC center of mass energy. So, for example, this thing here currently is 13 TeV. That's 13,000 GeV. So if we want to make a Higgs boson, for example, by a parton-parton collision, we want this thing here to be, roughly speaking, the Higgs mass times C squared, which is 125 GeV. So we see that we're going to have momentum fractions x, x1 and x2. If you think about it, if x1 and x2 are roughly equal, then this object will be more or less at rest in the laboratory. And so we will detect it in the central region of some detector. If x1 and x2 are very different, then it will be moving rapidly in one direction or the other. That may be more difficult to detect. So typically, we're probing the region of x about 0.01. So that's a pretty small momentum fraction. And you may say, what's the point of having such a high-energy machine if you're only going to probe 1/100th of the energy? So the answer is, when you look at the momentum distribution of these objects inside the proton. So let's have a look at the X distribution of various species of bartons. And we'll plot here, actually, X times F of X, which is the F of X is the probability distribution of the momentum fraction. So X times it is the fraction of the momentum carried by this particular object. And so you'll get something like the so-called valence bump here. The high X region is dominated by these valence quarks. So you'll have up and down quarks with this kind of distribution. And then you have, so this is the valence. And then you have gluons, which are less energetic. And then the C quarks and antiquarks, less energetic still. So that's gluons, and that's C.
Excuse me?
Yes.
Are these theoretical numbers, or are they experimental?
Well, these are measured, yes. I'm going to... the best way to measure these things is to scatter electrons off protons, not protons off protons. If you scatter electrons, then we've got a proton here. We've got some quark here, say, in the proton. You scatter an electron, as they used to do in Hamburg, at DAISY, then you've just got a hard interaction between this object and this part on here, which of course has got to be charged in order to be in order to scatter an electron. So you only see the quarks and antiquarks, but the quark distribution can be measured very well in this process, because it turns out you can determine the momentum fraction of this guy here simply by observing the scattering of the electron. This is called deep inelastic scattering. This was actually the process that showed us that the proton consists of point-like constituents.
How do you distinguish the C quarks from the V quarks? The C, S-E-A?
Yeah.
Bartons?
So you, So of course,
some kind of fluctuation.
You get some average of all the distributions. So you have to disentangle it somehow, and you can also get information, useful information, on the distributions from neutrino scattering, because neutrinos are again interact in a point-like way. They're not extended objects like protons, so that you get from neutrino scattering, obviously, is much more difficult, but then you get a different combination of the partons, and one way or another you can disentangle the distributions of the quarks and the antiquarks, and then you're left with the glue, which is the stuff that you don't see in these experiments, and you have to deduce that then either from parameterization of hadron-hadron, proton-proton collision, say, or you get some information from the fact that, of course, it's got to carry the momentum, which is not carried by the charged constituents. So you know at least the amount of glue, or the amount of momentum carried by the glue. So you know the integral under this curve here, just by subtraction. Now, the interesting thing is that you might naively think, well, this, once you've measured this, say, in this process, once and for all, then that's it. But actually, it's more complicated than that, because this depends on the scale at which you probe the structure of the proton. And in fact, that was the big discovery, one of the big discoveries in electron scattering, that if this four momentum transfer here, q mu, if the invariant four momentum transfer squared, q mu, minus, space-like, so we call it minus q squared, then actually these curves are a function of q squared. They vary essentially logarithmically with the momentum transfer scale. And what happens is that as you go up in q squared, the glue and the strain and the C go up, and the valence goes down. So that's as with increasing Q squared. So a process with a higher momentum transfer actually sees more glue and more antiquarks, and that's quite important for understanding the LHC. So why is that? Well, if you start thinking about the quantum theory of this process, then you realize that for larger and larger momentum transfers, you're, so to speak, probing shorter and shorter distances inside the proton. The wavelength of these virtual photons is getting shorter and shorter. And so you're starting to see some quantum fluctuations here. You know, all kinds of stuff which is going on a short distance scale. And you may, instead of hitting this guy here, you may hit one of these fluctuations. For example, this is a, say, a U-bar here. And so at high Q squared, you may hit this one. And then, of course, so I'll draw another diagram. When you hit this guy, then you knock that out of the proton, and then you're left with other stuff which has lower momenta than you would see at higher, at lower Q squared. And so you see more and more stuff as the probe gets shorter and shorter wavelength. And because the total momentum has to always add up, that means everything gets softer. Everything gets pushed towards lower momenta, and the amount of glue that you see goes up because of more and more fluctuations involving gluons. So let's think a bit more about Higgs production. So in Higgs production, as I said, we're down here somewhere like 0.01. So then you can see that the whole point of having the LHC is actually that you do want to get to rather low. You want to have collisions at rather low x because you want to have a lot of glue, because it turns out that the production process that dominates for the Higgs boson is gluon-gluon collisions and not quark-antiquark. So we'll discuss in a minute why that's the case. But for the moment, we see that we have a glue-glue collision making Higgs boson. And what happens then in the detector is that the Higgs boson decays into two photons. At least that's the mechanism by which it was discovered first. And the invariant mass of the diphoton adds up to give us a mass of the Higgs boson, which shows up as a peak in the diphoton mass distribution. So how do we compute the cross-section for this? The other important thing is to understand how we actually compute. So if we have the cross-section for, say, PP goes to Higgs plus anything, then we can factorize this into a convolution over these momentum fractions, dx1, dx2, f, say in general, fi of x1 times fj of x2 times what we would call sigma hat, the cross section for the fundamental process ij goes to Higgs plus anything where I and j are partons, that is to say quarks or gluons, in this case both gluons, and this is to be evaluated at the we said at the center of mass energy, which is the square root of x1 x2 times the LHC energy. So that's the so-called factorization formula or theorem. There's some subtleties about it, but that's the basic idea, that we can always do this once we've measured these, say for example in deep inelastic scattering, disentangled them somehow, we can do this convolution, and we just have to calculate this parton level, this gluon-gluon goes to Higgs process, in order to predict the cross-section. And what we find then is that this sigma Higgs is looks something like this. We've basically done two runs at the LHC, one at 8 TeV, one at 13 TeV, and the Higgs cross-section was about 25 picobarns at 8 TeV, and now at 13 in the current run, or in last year's run, it's gone up to about 50. So it went up primarily because we moved to lower X in the structure of the proton. You see, by going up to higher energy, you need a lower momentum fraction, and that's good because you get more glue. And so you actually get a higher cross-section by increasing the energy of the collider while remaining fixed at the energy of the primary process. Notice that Q squared doesn't change because the momentum transfer, so to speak, in this process is always of order of the Higgs mass. And so we're not talking about a change in Q squared here, changing the parton distributions. We're just talking about a change in the momentum fractions. Okay, let me just remind you of some units then. So one picobarn is in square meters 10 to the minus 40. So one femtobarn is 1/1000th of that, 10 to the minus 43 square meters. These are the interaction cross sections. And we usually express the power or the amount of events that we can produce for a given process by this thing which is called the integrated luminosity, which at 8 TeV, the machine ran for sufficient time with sufficient number of protons to give us essentially something of the order of 20 inverse femtobarns per experiment. And that means that for a cross-section of one femtobarn, you would get 20 events. And so the number of Higgs bosons was 25 times 20,000, so it was 500,000. So that's a heck of a lot of Higgs bosons. And the question arises, why was it so difficult to find them? Well, the difficulty is that they don't usually decay into gamma-gamma. In fact, the probability of a Higgs boson going to gamma-gamma is only 0.23%. And so that translates to only about 1,000. Higgs to gamma-gamma. Well, that's still quite a good number, and when you actually look at the data that the experiments, I should mention the two main experiments that discovered the Higgs boson, called, the collaborations called ATLAS and CMS, both of whom are well represented here, they essentially produced invariant mass plots looking very similar. Number of gamma gammas against, actually it was per 2 GeV mass spin. You have a background here, and then you have a bump on the background, something like that, at 125 GeV. I'm always setting the speed of light equal to 1, incidentally, so masses are in GeV. Now, when you look in more detail at the data, there's sort of like 4 bins here with a total of somewhat less than 1,000, about 800, I think, events in the bump. And they're sitting on a background here, which integrated over those bins is about 20,000. So you say, well, the signal is 800 events, and the background is 20,000, so the signal over background is would be that, which looks pretty tiny. But you have to remember that this number of events here will fluctuate typically by a number which is the square root of that. So the probability of this being a fluctuation is actually rather small, because this ratio here is 5.6. And so roughly speaking, that's why we say this is a 5 sigma bump, which classifies as a discovery. So it's clear, I think, and this background here comes from other standard model processes. For example, quark anti-quark goes to gamma gamma. If we draw a Feynman diagram, you can see that that's going to be a process which is easily computed, and you find that you more or less understand this background in terms of these other standard model processes. And what's more, you have lots of data above and below this resonant bump, and so even if you don't bother to compute the background processes, you can just draw a curve through here, which is more or less what the experimenters did. And so the estimate of the background under this bump is said to be data driven, and you don't really need any kind of detailed description of the background in order to discover the Higgs boson.
Brian, what was the uncertainty and the expectation of the cross section prior to the measurement, given that if you knew the mass?
Yeah. Well, I'll talk about that. Yes, it was quite high. I mean, it's been dramatically reduced over the past year or so by some people present here, or maybe no longer present here. But anyway.
There's something that we can learn from the background, too, or something new that we can learn from the background in terms of theoretical.
Well, we can check the standard model, of course, and it's always a good thing to have a calculation of the background, even if you don't need it to make the discovery, just to satisfy yourself that you understand what's going on. So certainly we can look at the accumulation of background processes and satisfy ourselves that they give a reasonable description of this. Now, there's an interesting sort of other example of this kind of discovery mode, which is going on right now at 13 TeV. So the Higgs discovery was down here. So here at 13 TeV, you can do the same thing. We make the mass plot of diphotons. And you might have heard that you see some interesting deviation, which may or may not be statistically significant. The problem is, at the moment, we have much less data at 13 TeV. The experiments are analyzing something on the order of 3 inverse femtobarns instead of 20. So what you see at 13 TeV, say 13 TeV, we have 3 inverse femtobarns per experiment. We can again plot M gamma gamma, now at much higher energies. So between a few hundred and 1 TeV, say, That is 1,000 GeV. And we have some data which comes down, and then we have some possible structure here, which may or may not be a bump at 750 GeV. That's certainly a very hot topic at the moment. Now, what I would say about that is, okay, in this case, there are about, so again, there it's binned, now it's in events per 20 GeV, so the bins are 10 times bigger. This bump appears in about four bins and consists of about 20 events. So now you have 20, and the background is about 27 events. I don't know, somewhere between 25 and 30. So you end up with something of the order of 3.9, which is interesting, because if this were a statistical fluctuation, it looks quite improbable. On the other hand, this is what the experimenters call the local significance of a bump here, if a bump at this mass is predicted. But if you're just looking for a bump anywhere in the mass spectrum, then you have the so-called look elsewhere effect, which means that you might see a fluctuation anywhere in the spectrum with this kind of significance, and then the overall significance is much lower. In any case, we don't count things as a discovery until we get to five, so it's obviously a very hot topic to generate what we hope will be sufficient statistics in this run this year, which, as you probably may or may not know, has been interrupted by a small animal crawling into one of the transformers, which has taken the whole machine down. So at the moment, the LHC is not running. But it did accumulate something like three inverse picobons before this minor disaster. So once it's up and running again, we can hope that we'll get enough statistics. The other thing I would like to say about this is that above the bump, again, in contrast to the Higgs, above the bump here, you only have about 12 events. Most of these bins here have just one event in them, and therefore your so-called data-driven estimate of the background becomes a little bit less secure, because you find you know the shape of the background down here below the bump, but you don't really know the shape here. You extrapolate through the bump with some parametric form, but if you got the wrong parametric form, then it might be like that, and the significance of your bump would be reduced. So, of course, we hope we're going to get more data, so this ambiguity will be resolved. But in circumstances like this, where you didn't have the option of getting more data, and that always tends to happen towards the end of the distributions of these masses and so on, when you're looking for bumps, that you really start to need to understand the background in more detail, in particular the shape of it, above whatever resonance you're looking for.
These numbers you gave were for both experiments?
Sorry?
The number counts are the same for both experiments, though?
Yeah, roughly.
So both experiments saw the bump?
No, well, CMS saw less significance, right?
Yes.
Yeah. The number I quoted is for ATLAS, actually. CMS see something there, but with less significance than
what ATLAS. Range of energies? What range of energies has been searched for bumps, then?
Well, they can search all the way up. As I say, the data run out. You've got like one event here at the order of one TeV. So you can look for bumps all the way from below the Higgs.
So what's is there a lower bound that's been searched? Or
In gamma-gamma? 200, right? Sorry. In the present run, yeah.
200 GeV.
This plot goes from 200 to about 1.
So the actual plot was from 150. The result was only estimated from 200, so the fit was only from
200. Yes, fit is done from 200. Certainly no sign of any other bumps near the Higgs boson. So you may say, well, all these things, you know, why look at gamma-gamma? It's such a hard business because you've got such a lousy branching ratio here into this channel. What about looking at the Higgs in other decay channels? And indeed, the Higgs goes prolifically into hadronic final states. That is, say, the Higgs boson couples to mass, right? It gives things their mass. And so if you look at BB bar, then that is, what is it, 56%. And indeed, glue-glue, we know it couples to glue-glue, although we'll discuss how in a moment. But we know that because that's how we reckon it was produced, and that gives a good description of the cross-section for its production. And that, indeed, the branching ratio into glue-glue should be 9%. So these are final states that would give us many, many more events. The problem is, of course, they would give us much, much bigger backgrounds as well, because these strongly interacting particles are much more copiously produced in parton-parton collisions. For example, glue-glue can go directly to glue-glue by elastic scattering with a very big cross-section. And then we will have a big background. And what's more, as I already said, we don't see gluons coming out directly in the way you see photons. The beauty of a photon is that it comes out and goes into your detector, and you can identify it as an elementary particle. It converts in some calorimeter, and you can measure its direction and energy with a good resolution. These things here are much more complicated because they don't come out. They actually have to form hadrons. They have to form bound states with other final state constituents before you see them. So now let's just think how the Higgs goes. So BB bar is straightforward. The Higgs boson couples to mass, so it gives the B quark its mass, and indeed there's an elementary vertex in the standard model. Therefore, that gives you a BB bar directly from a Higgs. But that's certainly not the case with the gluon, because the gluon is a massless gauge boson of an exact gauge symmetry. And so when the Higgs wants to decay into glue-glue, it certainly can't couple directly. But the gluon, of course, is a strongly interacting object, so it can interact with any other strongly interacting particle. And a good candidate here is the top quark, because the Higgs couples very strongly to the top quark, and so it can actually couple through a virtual TT bar pair. So that's what happens, and that's the thing you have to compute in order to find both this branching ratio here, which so far we haven't detected anyway because it's too difficult to see this final state above the enormous background. But to compute the production cross-section, then you need to compute the reverse of this process, which is the same calculation. So let me just give you a brief idea of what's involved in that calculation, because it really is heroic. I didn't have anything to do with it, but many people here, especially in the precision QCD workshop, are involved with it. You can see that even in lowest order perturbation theory, it's not simple because it's a loop diagram. So it has two strong interaction vertices and one so-called Yukawa coupling here. And so the cross-section for Higgs is going to be this fundamental cross-section for glue-glue goes to glue-glue goes to Higgs plus anything, is going to be in lowest order something of order alpha strong squared. We call that, say, sigma zero. That's the lowest order cross-section. Alpha strong is the strong coupling GS. So alpha strong is GS squared over 4 pi, in the same way that alpha, the electromagnetic coupling, is E squared over 4 pi. So we have two vertices here, and of course this is an amplitude, we have to square it, and so we get alpha S squared in lowest order, and then we'll get alpha S cubed corrections, which can come, for example, if we have some correction of this form here, another loop, and then what's actually being computed now, alpha S to the fourth plus alpha S to the fifth. And this cross-section here has now been computed, although in the approximation that you treat the top quark as infinitely massive. This is a technical point. This diagram has a finite limit when you take the top quark mass to infinity, because this coupling goes to infinity, but the loop goes to zero in such a way that the product is finite. And that's a reasonable approximation as far as we know, although there is scope for improvement. So I just wanted to write down what the 13 TeV cross-section is from all these contributions. So after convoluting with the parton distributions for the gluon and so on, then you get, in leading order, you get 20. This is in picobonds. You get 20. This thing is roughly... when you add this, it goes up to 34. When you add this, it goes up to 44. And when you add this, it goes up to 48. So this depends a bit on exactly what you include. But what I wanted to show you was that this is a very poorly convergent series in the first few terms. And it is only rather recently that we've been able to say that we know this production cross-section within, say, 5%. As a result of this calculation here, which is showing finally that the series is somewhat more convergent than it was initially. So factor of more than 2 compared with the lowest order diagram here. So I don't want to go on too long, but let me spend 5 minutes explaining in a little more detail how we simulate the final state in these processes. So let's go to a process like, let's say we were trying to simulate Higgs to glu-glu, or indeed glu-glu final states anyway. So we have our two protons here, and we have two gluons colliding. They may or may not make a Higgs boson, but in any case, let's look at the case that they produce a couple of gluons in the final state. So this is a large momentum transfer process, and that means there's a big acceleration of these objects here, which have the so-called color charge of the strong interaction. These are colored objects. That means they have couplings to other colored objects, which are of order unity. G sub s is of order unity. G squared over 4 pi is about 0.1. So they radiate a lot of stuff in this large momentum transfer process. So what actually is going to come out in this high momentum transfer process, leaving aside all the virtual corrections, there will be some real radiation which comes out in the final state, and it will make many, many hadrons. And where will these hadrons appear? Well, all these emission matrix elements have enhancements when the angle of emission of the radiation is small. So in a first approximation, these are almost collinear jets of gluons which come out in this process, and they indeed give rise to indirectly to so-called hadronic jets in the final state, which we can find with some algorithm which essentially looks for angular regions in the detector in which there's a very high deposition of energy. And you can see that we're also going to get so-called beam jets from the radiation from these incoming gluons, which will come out along the beam directions, which we may or may not see, because a lot of it will go down the beam pipe. So these jets here are going to have to convert themselves into jets of hadrons, which enter the detector. And how does that work? Well, let's think a bit more about the color structure. Let me slightly simplify. Let's just look at one of these jets here. So we have a gluon coming in, radiates some other gluons here because of the large momentum transfer. So if we draw the color associated with this gluon, we can make a simplification by saying that each gluon is a color anti-color doublet. It's actually a slight simplification, but for our purposes, we can say that there's a color associated with this gluon and an anti-color. So these are directed lines here. Color is like this, and anti-color is going in the opposite direction from the momentum. And so we can follow these colors through the final state. And what we end up with, I haven't got enough colors here, but, well, I've got three, but that should do, is we end up with color anti-color pairs, which actually are always matched up in this way. So we can take this color, this anti-color here, and we can match it with this color here, and we can put them together and make a color anti-color singlet, so-called. That is a color neutral object, which is a candidate then for some kind of hadronic final state. Similarly here and here. But then you see we've got these two here. These connect to somewhere else in the event, so that altogether, because we started with color neutral protons, we can always connect up the different jets in such a way that we end up with color neutral final states. And a simple model for this so-called hadronization process is to take these blobs here and just have them decay according to some phase-based prescription into individual hadrons which enter the detector. And that turns out to be quite a successful qualitative description. Now, of course, it would be nice if we had a fundamental theory for this process. It's a non-perturbative process because well, at the scale at which this is taking place, the strong coupling is growing. David here will explain to you that the strong coupling is not a constant. And in fact, it's going smaller and smaller at high momentum transfers and getting larger and larger at low momentum transfers. And These splittings here of this gluon into many, many lower energy gluons is actually a low momentum transfer process, and so it can't be treated with perturbation theory. And at the moment, we don't have any non-perturbative technique that will describe this process. So this has to be modeled with some purely phenomenological models to produce the hadrons in the final state. Of course, for some purposes, this doesn't matter, because if you just want to know where is there going to be a big energy deposition in your detector, then you may not need the details of how it's made up of individual hadrons. But actually, the experimenters usually do want to know, because they want to know how their detector is going to react to a particular combination of objects in the final state. For example, some of these hadrons are charged and they make tracks and in the detector, and you can measure the tracks and you can measure their momentum because you apply a magnetic field. Other hadrons here are neutral. They don't make tracks. They just deposit energy in other places in the detector. And unless you know the charged to neutral composition of the jet, you can't really predict how the detector is going to react. So this is a kind of open problem in simulating this process. And I think since I've already overrun 1 o'clock, that's maybe a good place to stop. Let me just summarize that we have a pretty good rough understanding of how all this works. We have, in principle, a fairly precise understanding of these hard high momentum processes that produce objects like the Higgs boson, and anything with a large momentum in the final state. We don't have a very profound understanding of how those objects, if they're colored, if they're strongly interacting, how they convert themselves into hadrons. We have a model, or alternative models, which do a fairly good job, but it would be nice to have a theoretical understanding. For some purposes, we don't need that too much, like here. In other places, we need it, and so there is room for improvement in that respect. So, well, I'll be happy to answer any questions, but I think I'll stop there.
So if I'm interested to find WIMPs as dark matter, are the lack of bumps in these diphoton graphs?
Yes, I was hoping to have time to talk a bit about searches for WIMPs. Because, of course, the thing about WIMPs or any other dark matter candidate is that you don't see it in the detector. So what you have to do is try to establish that it's been produced by looking for so-called missing energy, missing imbalance in the momenta of what you do see. Now, in many cases, the dominant cross-sections for the production of such an object would be via strongly interacting visible objects. For example, let's take gluon-gluon again. Gluon-gluon, a favorite thing that you might look for, is gluino production. Gluino is the super partner of the gluon, and it would give rise to, it typically would decay into quark-antiquark. So each gluino would decay into quark-antiquark plus a dark matter particle, which is a neutralino, which carries off the supersymmetric character of the gluino and leaves ordinary standard model particles which you can find. So in this final state you have four jets and a bunch of missing energy. So it's very difficult to look for a bump. You have to look for a distribution of the missing energy of four jet final states, and then you have to convince yourself there are zillions of standard model processes that give rise to such a final state. You have to convince yourself that there's some deviation which is due to this process giving you additional missing transverse energy. So, roughly speaking, missing energy distribution would show a bump at somewhere, but you certainly wouldn't get a resonance.
So this thing at 750 GeV has nothing to do with WIMP dark matter?
Gamma gamma. No, I don't think anyone is proposing. It's difficult, this gamma gamma thing, even into the supersymmetric scenario. It's kind of an embarrassment at the moment.
Yeah. What about intermediate black holes?
Oh, yes, of course. A favorite idea was that the LHC, well, not favorite, but an interesting possibility, which I worked on, is that you might make, if you have gravity with extra dimensions, you might make a mini black hole, which incidentally would decay very rapidly by Hawking radiation because it's very small. So you would look for the Hawking radiation, which in this case, from such a small object, would be very high energy, primarily very high energy part, quarks and gluons and all kinds of stuff coming out roughly isotropically. So the experimenters have certainly looked for that, and they've got lots of good limits on it, and it seems like that's one of the several ideas about physics beyond the standard model, which is in the process of being killed by the experiments.
Let me go back to the question I asked about for the diphoton, the 25 picobar measurement.
Yeah?
What, given, if theorists knew the mass, what would have been the error bar on the prediction for the cross-section?
For the Higgs, you mean?
Well, this is a different argument, yeah.
Are you talking about
the Higgs? Yeah, but it was, yes.
For the Higgs, yeah, of course. Now we know this number. We're perfectly happy with the size of the bump. And indeed, the name of the game is, of course, to try and see whether there's any deviation from the standard model predictions. Now we know the Higgs mass. We know all the parameters of the standard model. And so we can compute anything which is perturbatively calculable with high precision with enough resources like this. And what we want to know is, are there any deviations from the, you know, like from this, is it really 0.23% or is it something else? And we want to go through all the couplings of the Higgs boson. For example, any deviation might indicate that there's another Higgs boson, which is a very models have an extra Higgs boson at a higher mass or even at a lower mass sometimes. And then its couplings would be shared out probably with other Higgs bosons, and so you'd see deviations. But so far, we haven't seen any. But of course, it's early days yet because the precision will improve.
So what type of improvements are you expecting in the future on the background and the peak determination there?
Well, there's already been a calculation of this background, the standard model background to such an object. So we do actually believe that the parameterization that the experiment is using is close to what we expect from calculation, theoretical calculations. So there's no particular problem with the background estimation, and so indeed, I suspect with more statistics we'll find whether this is a fluctuation or not, and probably the estimation of the background will be pretty solid.
So I was asking, how good statistics are you planning to have in the future?
Well, if they get 30 inverse femtobars this year, then they'll have 10 times more data, so the error bars will go down, the statistical errors will go down by a factor of 3. There'll be systematics, but you see that would be more than enough to make this thing significant if it's there. I don't know, the experimenters can possibly comment on what they expect by the end of the year. Certainly more than 5 sigma, if it's there.
Even by eye check, we should have been by some.
So, yeah, it's a very interesting thing because, as I said, it's somewhat outside the range of most models of physics beyond the standard model, and it doesn't fit conveniently in any of the existing models, should I say, and therefore it would be, in a way, that's much more exciting in a way because it means there's something out there that we really need to understand.
Great. Thank you very much.